Welcome to Money, Markets and Masterminds, a CityWire South Africa podcast that delves into the intricate world of finance, investment and strategic decision making. If you're a fund selector or an independent financial advisor looking for insights, analysis and expert opinions to enhance your perspective, you're in the right place here with me, editor Ruan Uestam. I'm broadcasting from Fan Court in a very wet George today, where the CityWire South Africa and CityWire event teams are hosting the country's annual flagship retreat, rubbing shoulders with the elite of local fund selections and some titans of the global asset management industry. The event is already in its fourth year, but it's my first as editor. And also for my guest today, Mubuzu Nkubani, the Deputy General Secretary at NUMSA's first time as well. NUMSA is the biggest trade union in South Africa, with around 340,000 members. Mubuzu is a key member of the executive committee, and his responsibilities include directing the day-to-day operations and managing relationships with strategic stakeholders of NUMSA members across a myriad of sectors, including retirement funds in the manufacturing, mining, and automotive sectors. Welcome, Mubuzu.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Yes.
Before we start talking shop, and because it's so fresh in our memories, and because we have less than 2 weeks to form a coalition, establish a parliament, and elect a president, What was organized labor's first reaction to the election results? And what do you want to happen in the shorter and near term in this political space?
Well, look, the labor movement has always been in a struggle, but the struggle is clearly a working class struggle, because we understand that our society is formed of classes, and therefore our interest as labor has always been clear that we represent those who are suffering, who are sweating under the machines in the manufacturing and other related industries. And for us, is how those members actually benefit from the surplus value that they generate in the, across all the sectors that where they are actually made to sell their energy and time and everything else for bosses to be able to enjoy their dividends and all of that. And clearly, we have been also been clear that, particularly as NUMSA, we're not just a trade union movement. We are also a revolutionary trade union, meaning that we also link the workplace struggles with those of the community struggles, because we understand that before we are workers, we are also members of our own communities. And the social ills that are confronting our communities are the same social ills that are affecting us as the organized working class, and all the sections of the working class. To us as NUMSA, we represent them, the employed and the unemployed. And I must say that we also understand that going to the elections is not necessarily what we get excited about, because we know that those are bourgeoisie elections. They get managed by the system. The workers have got a small voice, or the working class have got a small voice, who are made to actually go for elections, and there will be hype that is created behind. But we know that at the end of the day, the very important person in that process is those who are counting, and those who are finally counting, especially those who are high-hearted to manage and control the IT systems. Mm-hmm. A particular outcome will be determined at that point. And you would have seen what would have happened. There are a lot of allegations that have been raised. And if you look at social media, there are some of the evidence that have been shown by ordinary people on the ground of what has been happening. And we know that also the IEC, which is the one that controls and operates in terms of that space, they're not neutral. Even you look at people that get employed there to run those elections, we know that they're not neutral. And those are some of the challenges that we're confronted with as the working class. And we're worried that in South Africa, the working class have not been able to attain economic freedom. Mm. where we our own people are still living in squalor, we are still in deep poverty, and the levels of inequality are really deepening. And we are worried about that. We look at the majority number of our young people are unemployed. Our society have been made to rely on what they call the government subsidies and you can't live out of that. We need our people to be active in the economy. We need our people to be given a chance in the actual economy. And when I'm talking about the actual economy, where they can be part of the actual production in terms of ownership of the means of production, if I were to put it that way, not to make our own people to be on the last line of the economy, where they will never be able to improve their livelihood, where they can't even be able to afford the normal livelihood, where they continue to live below belt in terms of the income that they are getting for those who are employed, and where the massive of our people are continue to be unemployed. So those are some of the challenges. So when it comes to the result, we can say that we would have we still have to have engagement concretely as the organization, but where I'm seated as the DGS of NUMSA, I would have observed a number of dynamics emerging out of this result. And there are questions that we keep on asking ourselves as to what is it that is happening here, because looking at the dynamics that would have been at play, you would have seen that you have the ANC on the other side, you have the DA, you have the emergence of Umkhonto weSizwe, you have the Patriotic Alliance, if we have Inkatha Freedom Party. But if you look at how the vote turned out and how these other parties were eating from each other, you will then have more questions than answers. Because, for instance, you will find that particularly the Democratic Alliance still retained 3 million voters. And you ask yourself, how is it really the reflection? And you then have those allegations that are being raised by Umkhonto weSizwe to say they are not convinced based on the evidence that they claim to have and what was also seen being trending in the social media. And you ask yourself, how can the DA get more votes than Umkhonto weSizwe and so forth and so forth? And how does the system works? Because even prior to those elections, you would have heard that there were already talks about the coalition, and already the ANC and the DA would have already been engaging on the coalition engagement. So why would you have those coalition engagements when you're supposed to wait and see what could be the consequence? And as a result of the consequences, you can then determine the way forward. Should it be that these elections were stage managed? Those are some of the questions that we're asking ourselves. But at the end of the day, the most question that we're asking ourselves, what the working class stands to benefit out of the outcome of these elections, which is much more important, because ours is that we need to have a situation where the outcome of the elections are actually about the people, where we do away with neoliberal policies, where we adopt more pro-working class policies, where people can be able to benefit directly from the mineral resources that we have in the country. I mean, South Africa is a very rich country, but even today we're struggling to beneficiate those raw materials that we have, and so forth and so forth. And those are some of the questions that we keep on asking ourselves, that if you talk about democracy, it's democracy for who? If it means that our people continue to suffer under the what so-called democratic dispensation.
Mubuso, you also provide oversight to NUMSA trustee representatives across a number of pension funds for your members. There's around 350 billion rand in assets under management, which is quite a lot of money. But if you look at the FECA website, the list of pension funds that are under curatorship is staggering.
Sure.
There's another a list of employers not paying over their pension funds, and that list is getting longer. The scandals around Steinhoff that cost pensioners billions of rands, not even millions. Of course, other corruption and scandals do the same. Do you think trustees are doing enough in their fiduciary duty, in due diligence, in educating their members or keeping an eye on events to keep the workers' money, their years of saving, safe?
Look, that is a very fundamental question that we are raising. And I think starting from the point where you started, where when there is a white entity corrupting the monies of the workers, you'll firstly see that the way it gets reported and the way it gets characterized, they'll never even say it's corruption, you know. And they'll say it's financial irregularities, and it's alleged. And you'll not even get a sense of the agents in terms of investigations. And even when you look at the media coverage, there will be very less media coverage. And you are mentioning the Steinhoff as an example. It affected a number of workers or number of funds cutting across sectors in the economy. But yet the media has been reporting very less about it. And that is the kind of a situation that we're confronted with in South Africa, that they look at the color of your skin for them to expose you and for them to tell the truth. And if you come to the capabilities of our trustees, we must say that it has been a long journey and a very difficult journey for our trustees, because the system it has been designed in such a way that they must be less capable of determining the future and all other things in the best interest of our members. But we've been making sure that they get trained, and we have seen the improvement. And gradually they are moving away from being captured by some of the service providers that are there who would have taken advantage on the basis of their economic position, which is poor in essence. And the introduction of Regulation 28 would have also pushed our trustees to be more vigilant and to be more concentrating as to how are they also balancing between the listed and unlisted asset globally and domestically. Tracing, having that a kind of an interest, because if you trace the history, you'll find that our members have always been unhappy about the growth of their funds, and which is what our trustees are working on. And for sure, there's more to be done. And when you are saying there's more to be done, is that the fiduciary duty should not be used for trustees to be, for instance, to be far away from their unions. The fiduciary duty should not be used to isolate the structures of the unions from giving a proper mandate and accountability to trustees and capacitating them. Fiduciary duty should be also be reviewed so that in that context, so that they can be able, so that unions themselves can be directly involved, can directly give mandate, can directly correct whatever that needs to be corrected. Because from time to time, our trustees get they get challenged because of the system that has been put in place to make it difficult for them to do what they're supposed to do. So those are kind of challenges that we currently having and we're currently engaging on, particularly as NUMSA, to say how do we ensure that our trustees, they keep on improving, but also the environment and policies are such a way that allows the labor movement to be directly engaging with the funds.
I want to get a better feel of how investment decisions are made under your purview. What's the process and how important are investment consultants in this process?
Look, the process is such that there will be subcommittees and the investment subcommittee that will always be at the center. And our trustees will then entrust that subcommittee to deal with the details. And that subcommittee and trustees at the board level, they will then be able to also identify those consultants to do some research on their behalf, investment research, and present their case and allow trustees to engage on those. But we should also be doing more on that, because some of those consultants, they don't ensure that the monies that are invested are actually invested differently, targeting the new approach, where you're saying, how do you use those investments, firstly, to improve the life of the same fund members? Because what is funny here is that workers are told that you can only enjoy your money when you have retired, or you will have to die first and your family will then enjoy that money. But in between, the same money is used for other people, particularly the elite. Those are the ones who've got access to the monies of the workers. They are living large to that money of the workers. And recently, the government is now adopting bills that are going to allow them to have their hands in the workers' monies and so forth. But you'll then find that most of those members, they even struggling in getting proper housing, because they don't qualify for government subsidy. But also banks are not also giving them loans to be able to build their own houses. But yet they are contributing to these funds, which are said to have a lot of money. And ours is that money is supposed to be used to improve the livelihood of the same members first. Invest on them whilst they're in the employment. That's our goal. Invest on them. Let them be able to enjoy that money, and we can then leverage from there and produce more money out of those particular initiative, particularly providing those housing and so forth for our members. So that is those are some of the things that we think should be considered, especially when it comes to those consultants. You can't have continuously having those conservative approach in terms of investing the monies of the workers. We must now do things differently. That is our approach.
You mentioned some of the bills and that are being passed. President Cyril Ramaphosa signed the two-pot system into law last week. It's going live on the 1st of September, where workers or members of pension fund can access a small portion of their pension every year, but also two-thirds will stay there and stay there for longer, which will be greater for them in the long term, and they will have a more wealth when they retire. How do you and your representative trustees feel about these proposals that will now be implemented on later this year?
Look, there are challenges on it, because as I was saying that for instance, workers, they normally survive from hands to mouth, and this is the same money that they will think that at a particular point in time they'll get the lump sum and they'll be able to intervene on their financial challenges. I mean, they are in debt, they still have to take their children to schools. And remember, also got what we call black tax as South Africans. You look after your siblings, you look after your aunt, your uncle, and so forth. And there are other financial challenges that we continuously live with during our employment time. So some of those challenges, they remain with us. And this two-pot system also, you accessing just a small amount of money is not going to help. I mean, we are told around 30,000 and so forth and so forth. It's not going to help. And what we've also recently learned is that you can even cash that small amount of money. But if you are owing SARS, SARS will take it immediately at the same time. And you might not necessarily get even that money. So there is a very weak reinforcing of that particular process. So for us, we actually don't think that it will make any fundamental difference in terms of the financial challenges that are confronting our members.
You also mentioned that a lot of the pension money is not being distributed or invested in the right way in the communities of the members that support them. One is buying property, creating wealth that way. But pension funds are allowed to be used as collateral to purchase property. And also, we just talked about the two-pot system. How are your representative trustees trying to educate your members about these options and what they can do and actually utilize these savings of them in a positive way to create wealth, maybe break that cycle of poverty that you prefer to?
Look, the trustees are always keen in ensuring that, and together with our unions, to ensure that they educate our members, because the more you educate our members, the more the life and the work of the trustees will become easier, and they will better understand when they look at their statements to say what is actually happening there and there. However, the system does not also allow trustees to be able to do that effectively, because at some point they need to be supported in order to be able to do that. So if they are not supported, if the funds are unable to be flexible in terms of that area, in terms of, so that they can do proper awareness in workplaces, so that they can be able to ensure that our members are consciously enough about what is happening, about the roles and everything else. So it will remain an idea that trustees wish to do. But in the absence of a support from the funds, as it is currently, they will not be able to achieve that kind of an objective.
You mentioned changes to Regulation 28 of the Pension Funds Act earlier. And I want to talk global and local, listed, unlisted, all four that you've mentioned before. How do you approach or see this split in being responsible, being risk-adjusted, and also investing in the people that are members of this fund?
Look, I think we really need to have a brutal and honest dialogue when it comes to that, because we know that we are not in control of the market, especially when you talk about whether it's global or domestic, we're not in control. However, if we're to be able to say all parties involved in terms of social partners, what is it that we envisage in here? And at the center should be about improving the livelihood of the same fund members. And we can therefore be able to say what could become a strategy that can address the market, but also addressing the needs of the working class and the working people, so that we are, and at the same time, the government interest as well in addressing some of its challenges. And but at the center, generating more money as well for fund members. So if we are unable to have that kind of a dialogue and willingness to do so, and we think that the current system is comforting on one side, and when it's comforting on the one side, then things are normal, we'll still have these kind of challenges. But if all we are saying, let's have a sort of a win-win situation where we all say these are the things that are needed, and how do we then balance across so that we can all be able to say who does what and who is responsible for what and how to uplift the livelihood of the fund members in particular. I think we'll be able to come up with a solution.
I want to step out of the investment realm before we close up this conversation. What are some of the biggest challenges that organized labor is facing at the moment as a social partner, as a political ally, as a representative of the workers? And what efforts are being made to address these challenges?
Look, labor movement currently is confronted with a number of challenges, I can tell. And even the recent lockdown due to COVID-19 has brought about new challenges as well. The labor movement is losing members because there are a lot of jobs that are being shelved. So many companies could not survive COVID-19. The economy has been struggling in such a way that some companies are massively retrenching our members. But also the question of casualization continues to be a challenge, because once we've got a sizable number of workers who are casualized, they are unable to take permanent and informed decisions because they don't know what will happen with their employment in the next 2-3 months to come. It poses a lot of challenges. But I can tell you that, again, the labor laws as well are a challenge to the labor movement, because even the recent amendment in the Labor Relations Act were not necessarily the amendments that were favorable to the workers, but it was a process toward ensuring that the employers are more powerful in terms of being able to hire and fire at any time and making it difficult to defend our members at CCMA or Labour Court. So it's very difficult for labor movement to survive. You can even tell that we've got a very sizable number of workers who are unorganized across all sectors as we speak. Because another thing is that they're earning a very little, and some of them, when they compare that, because remember, unions, they survive through subscriptions. So one will then calculate and say, hey, instead of paying for a subscription for a union, I need to take this money and buy an additional item for grocery or electricity or something else. And in that process, they get more and more exploited because they've got no voice to defend them, and their voices are unorganized. Because one of the things is that labor movement survived with one voice. When workers are organized and they've got one voice and they are united, that's the most weapon that they have. Because remember that when they enter the workplaces, they don't own anything there. They own nothing. And if they are divided and they are unorganized, they are unable to challenge some of the unbecoming tendencies and attitudes and everything else that are unleashed against them. So the role of the labor movement is more important than ever before, because the system is such that it is actually in bashing the existence of the labor movement. When the labor movement has always been positioning itself to try and be more progressive and try and be more engaging and sharing ideas and to some extent willing to reach consensus. Because, for instance, you look at the inflation rate, you'll find that comparing with the salary or wage increases, workers, they always get lesser compared to what they're supposed to be getting. Even when you look at how the companies would have performed, you'll see that there's no sharing of the proceeds that are generated out of the sweat of the workers. And if we have a government that is not willing to uplift the life of its own people and allowing the neoliberal policies to be to take the center stage, you will continuously have these kind of problems where unions now are not expected to be revolutionary and fight and understand that where what they cannot achieve in the base, they must go. They must opt for the theater of struggle, which is the street, where they must be modernized, where they must just accept what they are given. I mean, for the first time, we would have witnessed a situation where public sector employees were not given their increase when they would have signed the wage or salary increase. But eventually, the government said, we're not going to give you money, and so forth. Those are some of the things that shows that there's no willingness on the side of government in improving the life of our own people, particularly those who are working.
So that's all the time we have for today, but thank you for taking time in your very busy schedule to come and talk to me. And I hope you enjoy your first CityWire retreat with us.
Thank you so much. I'm looking forward.
To all our CityWire South African listeners, thank you for tuning into this episode of Money, Markets and Masterminds with me, editor Ruwan Uester, and my esteemed colleagues here with me. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. We are available on all major platforms such as Spotify, Google, and Apple Podcasts. From a very rainy fan court, and until next time, goodbye.